Okay, I'll move on now to Jane and Tony. Your turn, guys. Jane and Tony, if you've got something to say, you need to unmute.
Sorry, I never managed that. So about allotments, what I've noticed, I've had an allotment for quite a while now, and I've known people who had allotments for decades. And what I've noticed is that in back in the day, so to speak, allotments were very much a working class thing, and people grew on their allotments to supplement their food supply. But I guess as food has become much cheaper because it's mass produced in ways it wasn't before, what's happened on the allotment I've got, for example, and what I've heard is the same as all over, the working class are moving off the allotments, and the allotments are becoming it's like my allotment, I can't move for middle class families enjoying themselves playing at being market gardeners or something like that. It's become a completely different thing. It's no longer about growing veg to eat it. It's about playing at being whatever. I don't know what the fuck they're trying to do, really, and half of them give up very quickly when they realise they actually have to do work at it. But the class nature of it has completely changed. I think that's really interesting. For me, it is anyway. Also, rather depressing.
You're totally right, Tony. I was one of those really rubbish ones. I didn't think I was playing at it. I actually meant to do it, but I had to walk right across town with tools every time, and it was just, it was too hard. And when you work out the finances of it, you know, you're cheaper to go to the supermarket. So I was quite cold blooded about it.
Thank you. Okay, Mike, you're next, comrade.
Yeah, thank you. Very interesting talk, Paddy. Yeah, enjoyed that a lot, and yeah, lots to chew over. one thing I wondered if you had any thoughts on was vertical farming. Not something I know too much about. Just had a quick skim read on Wikipedia, but it tends to be indoors and growing crops, on sort of big frame towers without soil, it seems very intensive in terms of the sort of technology and the setup of it, but apparently it sort of pays off in efficiency and growing sort of uniform crops that they can sort of manage quite precisely. Sort of factory farming for lettuces or strawberries. I wonder if you had any thoughts on that. I mean, I guess that'd be quite useful for agriculture within cities, whether in capitalism or in socialism. So, you know, you can grow stuff and it, you know, that doesn't need to travel very far. I don't know if it suffers with the, sort of the quality of the food, if it's sort of factory farmed in that way. So, yeah, I just wonder if you had any thoughts on vertical farming or anyone else. Yeah, thank you.
Vertical farming is one of those sort of emergent technologies that's been tried on a large scale in China and a few other places as well. There's also hydroponics. There's also underground farming, converting old basements and cellars and garage lots to this sort of thing. And it's the quality is really good because they're usually grown in sort of, virtually clean room conditions, you know, so there are no pests, no diseases. You know, people walk around in hazmat suits quite, in these sort of things. So, I mean, it's really good quality. The main drawback of them is the energy that they require for all those lights to run. So we've got a problem to solve there globally, that we need to produce enough sustainable energy. At the moment, we're still getting most of it from coal and oil globally, about 60%, 70%, something like that. So that's going to have to change before things like vertical farming, hydroponics and so forth are going to really take off. But also, where are you going to put these vertical farms? You know, if you're going to put them in blocks of flats, are you going to be, you know, are people going to be able to live there as well at the same time, or you know, are we going to add to the homeless problem? I don't know. These are sort of all questions that you know, the world could look into. But certainly, very promising new technologies. All of these things.
That okay, Mike? Yeah. Okay. Another question from Freddie.
Yeah, I think it's worthy of comment on this question of allotments, where it was mentioned earlier on, like some sort of middle class, so-called middle class type activity. Well, it may be in some parts of the country, but I can certainly tell you that in South Yorkshire, and then the allotment holders that I'm acquainted with, it's far from some sort of middle class activity. And Steve mentioned earlier on about when was the last time you tasted a half-decent tomato. Well, you know, you can grow them on an allotment quite easily without with just using what sun there is, and you can get quite tasty tomatoes from that. And allotments are becoming, again, I suppose I can really only comment on the area in which I live. There's now a waiting list to go onto allotments, and the idea that it can't be time consuming. I agree with that. It can be time consuming, but the quality of what it is you get is certainly superior to what you will is generally superior to what you can go and get in the supermarkets. So. I think the idea of allotment growing is beneficial overall in terms of how we produce things. Yeah, within capitalism, it is, allotment growers don't do it for profit. They do it for the very reason that it's more satisfying to undertake that sort of activity and be able to grow your own crops and share it where necessary. So I wouldn't criticise the allotments, or some of it sounds like criticising unnecessarily.
There you go. So just before I take Howard, I noticed that Vin's coming up too, and that's great. And, you know, I just encourage other comrades, you know, if you've got something bubbling away in your mind that you like answering or you like to contribute to, one thing we notice about these talks most weeks that, you know, we get the same old contributors all the time, and great as they are. It'd be nice to hear from other people. You know, there's no such thing as a daft question, a silly question. If there's anything even remotely that you feel that you'd like to say, then please don't hold back. Come forward and ask your question or get your comments, and that way we get a greater variety of contributions. And so that said, Howard, you've always got something interesting to say, comrade. Fire away.
Thanks, Paul.
Just mean that in the nicest possible way.
Right, okay. Just a word about the potential for food production. Early in the history of Discord, of our Discord platform anyway, I did a talk about food production based mainly on a book I'd read called Cetopia by Caroline Steele. I mean, some people may remember bits of it. I do, but only bits, I'm afraid. But what I remember from it was that her mentioning the fact that the FAO made clear that farmers worldwide currently produce enough food per person to feed the world. equivalent of 2,800 calories, so more than enough to go around. She wisely added to that, given an ideal food system. So, you know, and that sort of picks up what Paddy said about people will only get the food if they can afford it. They've got money to buy it. In her book, she mentions another book entitled Waste by Tristram Stewart. And in that book, what the author does is to point to ways in which one third of the global food supply could be saved, and that would be enough to feed the world's hungry 23 times over. And just to mention aeroponics, since I think it was Mike who mentioned it a few minutes ago, she goes into a bit of detail about the potential of this vertical farming, and she describes a vertical aeroponics farm in a disused steel mill in Newark. So, you know, no problem, not the problem that Paddy suggested might happen, that you'd be building these farms at the expense of housing in a disused steel mill there, for in Newark, New Jersey. It has all year-round production, multiple growing layers, and up to 30 annual harvests of all the crops you can imagine. She even gave it a name. It's called AeroFarm, and it yields 130 times more than a conventional farm, and that's all without soil, sun, pesticides, or tractors. So there is definitely a lot of potential in that kind of thing, which clearly won't be fully, or should we say humanely, realised in the society we live in, but it sort of gives hope for the future.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Howard. I mean, I didn't mention waste. That was one of the things I left out. But yeah, 30% of food wasted globally. Storage and packaging and, refrigeration are lacking in a lot of parts of the world. So you see sort of up to 80% of food wasted in supply chains in developing countries because of lack of preservation techniques and plastic wrapping. That's compared to about 4% in Western supply or advanced capitalist supply chains. So an awful lot of food is going to waste for no really good reason.
Okay, Vin, your next comrade, fire away.
Hi, guys. I thought I'd speak as an allotment holder. It's true. This year, more people have, I think, been wanting to take up allotments. But as someone who's had an allotment for, 20 years, what I do notice is that people come on with a great deal of enthusiasm. And last, I would say maybe half of them are there the second year. After you've done it a while, yeah, it is good. It's not really time consuming if you do it properly. And I think it would be a good way of having sort of open land and people being able to, yeah, you'd be able to get the vegetables for a local community quite easily if with all these completely useless jobs no longer there, you know, ticket collectors, policemen, bank tellers, you know, there's going to be plenty of spare capacity for people just sort of like prat about on the land. But, you know, it can be a bit antisocial as well. You know, there's always a few miserable old buggers on the plots whose aim seems to be to make life miserable. But, you know, we're not going to have any of them under socialism, obviously. Okay, that's my two penneth.
Well said. I think it can be quite competitive amongst some of the holders as well. You know, who's got the biggest marrow and all that, but maybe that's for another day.
I've just got to I've got to say, all this talk about allotments is making me feel deeply inadequate. But I, I own up to being a de-skilled, clueless urbanite, but I am very willing to undertake instruction.
Well, it's just a matter of getting started, you know. Like when I, the first time I had an allotment, which I only had for about 6 months, I was like in my mid-20s, I was pretty fit, and my half plot was a right state. And the bloke next to me had 2.5 plots, and he'd retired because he had emphysema, and they were all in perfect nick. You know, there's nothing on the inadequacy you feel.
When no, that's just making me feel worse, Vin.
You're gardening next to someone who can hardly walk.
No, I just feel worse.
No, you shouldn't, Paddy. You shouldn't.
Moving on to Adam now. Comrade Buick, what would you like to say?
I can agree that the ideal situation is to grow food as near as possible to where it's consumed. But I'm not convinced that this can be done just by return to the manorial system or on allotments. I'm not even convinced it could be done for a staple which is used in North America, Europe, and the Middle East, wheat. I mean, surely there must be a place for big farms growing this sort of thing. And I mean, I'm looking now on the table on which this laptop is. I can see oranges and bananas. I mean, they can't be grown, can't intelligently or rationally be grown in this part of the world. And then there's tea and coffee. So there will have to be some sort of transportation, you know, something grown in parts of the world where it can be grown best and then transported to here. Even now, at this time of year, I mean, tomatoes and peppers, they're grown where? In Israel or the south of Spain or something like that, and then they're here. If this didn't happen, the diet of people like us living in this part of Northern Europe, what would we have to eat? You know, potatoes, cabbage, Swedes and things like that. I mean, that's not in favour of socialism to be forced to eat those sort of things. So I'd just like to ask Paddy if he does see any place for big farms. I mean, the parts of the, you know, the prairies of North America, they're very sparsely populated. Why couldn't they still be used in socialism to grow wheat for those parts of the world where it's the staple diet? Okay, thanks.
I agree with you, Adam. I certainly wasn't trying to imply, well, I didn't mean to imply that there would be no big farms. I mean, I would never make that claim because I think that would be bloody stupid. You're right. I mean, you've got thousands of square miles of prairies in the States. So the idea of having sort of manorial strip farming system there just seems bloody silly. But I think that it's I just simply mentioned the manorial system. I just kind of threw it in there, really. Just the idea that, you know, the future doesn't always have to be high tech, and it doesn't always have to be bigger, better, faster, cheaper. It sometimes, and I think we've sort of touched on this in past discussions. You know, you can look back at what used to happen and think, well, would that work better in some cases? And that's what I'm trying to argue, really, that I think in some cases, particularly in Britain, I mean, Britain at the moment it imports, you know, around about 25%, 30% of its produce, mostly Mediterranean stuff that we can't grow or we can't grow economically here. Because, you know, if you try and grow Mediterranean vegetables in heated greenhouses, you end up spending more on carbon impact than if you shipped them from Spain. So things like oranges, bananas, coffee, in theory you could grow them here in heated greenhouses, and maybe you could. It would depend on future energy revolutions. I've just been reading just today about a new idea about salt batteries, sodium-based batteries, that could be the next breakthrough beyond lithium. And then room temperature superconductor technology, which is resistance-free electricity. So you don't lose any electricity in transit. It's not lossy. you keep it all. So there could be future energy revolutions that make it actually feasible to grow oranges, bananas, coffee, and so forth in Britain. You know, if we're just talking about this particular, you know, little island. I was also looking at a thing, again, it was something that Paul Bennett wrote about, reviewing a book on who owns England. And who owns, you know, the amount of farmland in England is a small percentage of the total area, and the largest area of land in Britain is owned by the rich, you know, you know, in their private estates and their private golf courses and all this sort of thing. I could dig out the statistics, but the actual built area of the land on in the British Isles, you know, that's land on which anything artificial exists at all, is about 4% of the land area. So there's an absolutely enormous potential for expanding food production just in this island, without even thinking about sort of getting food from elsewhere. The question of sort of international transport of food products, I think we'd have to wait until socialism to work out how that would work. But I think on the basis that we would mostly favour, or socialism would mostly favour, local production where possible, you would be looking at, if it's possible, local production of, you know, most of the things you need. So, you know, I think there's a lot of potential here. And, you know, just to address your point, it's different modes of production for different places, depending on the terrain, the climate, the soil and all those things.
Good stuff. So back to Jane and Tony. Jane and Tony, what would you like to say?
Hello, it's Jane this time. The slide I think I found the most chilling of the slides that you put up, Paddy, was the one that indicated that current and future farming is going to be dominated by the players like Amazon, Google, and you sort of said, I think, that you didn't think there was any possibility for small farmers to resist this takeover. I wondered if anybody, not necessarily putting Paddy on the spot here, had any update on the farmers' strike in India, and whether people think, where people think this concentration of food production is going to go, and how that might end up really concentrating people's minds on precipitating some sort of disaffection and then revolution, revolutionary potential. Thank you.
Right, OK, so I don't know anything about the farmers' strike in India, so I don't know. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that, Jane?
So my understanding is that currently there's a system in India in which there are government-set prices and some government subsidy of the food market, which has enabled... So my understanding is, at the moment, the bulk of India's food production, as I think you indicated for some other countries in the world, Paddy, is done on its relatively small scale. So we're talking about small and medium-sized farmers. Now, Modi is planning to get rid of that national system of food pricing. So this is all very sketchy. My understanding is that the farmers either sell to the government and they sell on, or the government fix the prices. And that, I'm not saying that the Indian farmers are doing well, but Modi wants to open it up to international capitalism. And of course, then they will be forced to compete. And there was one What the Indian farmers were saying, that if they don't win this, that they're basically, most of them are going to the wall. And there's probably a lot of you will already know, there's an extremely high suicide rate amongst farmers in India, small farmers, because they are already in hock to people like Monsanto, who have patented their seeds, and they now can only buy things like F1 hybrids, so that they can't do any seed collection and generation themselves. And I find this really quite a frightening future. What the farmers have done, they have come from all over the country and they've encircled Delhi. And my understanding is they've blocked a lot of entry routes into Delhi. The army have been brought out. There's hundreds of thousands of them. They set up their own kitchens, their own sleeping quarters. They distribute toothbrushes. I mean, they're saying they're just going to stay there, because if they go home and this legislation is changed, they've got no future to go home to. So and I just wondered if anyone else knew anything about that. Okay. I see somebody's put up a note. Adam, maybe you could tell us a little bit about it.
Can you add to what you said there, Adam? Is that possible? Give the game away in advance of the article.
It wasn't me that written the article. It's Alan Johnson, who does our blog. It's basically what Jane has said. I would think the figure isn't hundreds of thousands. It's millions, but it seems to be an attempt to introduce more capitalistic aims into. There's also been a discussion website forum where somebody made the point that actually it might not be a bad thing in itself if people left farming to move to the cities as in other countries. I mean, as you can expect, that has caused some controversy, and not all members, people on the forum agree to that. But that has been the tendency, as has been pointed out, I think, isn't it, about the enclosures and so on, and how that happened in Western Europe, and I think it happened to a certain extent in China. But obviously, we even if we agreed this is a good idea, it would have to be applied in socialism on a voluntary basis, not be forced out by economic circumstances. Anyway, that the article doesn't take that point. The article takes the point of view that you've been expressing, Jane.
Thanks, Adam. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Paddy?
Only that if it's coming out in next month's Standard, I must have read it. So this must just show that useful information is crowded out of my head in order to make way for trivia. So apologies for not remembering that. I did recall that after Jane mentioned it. This is the process of globalisation, isn't it? I mean, it's just hellish for. Well, as I said, I mentioned earlier, for small farmers, and clearly this is happening already. One thing to notice about big tech, though, is they are under attack in various places. The EU is threatening to regulate them. Australia is threatening to bring in laws, and Google is threatening to leave Australia. And there's even rumblings in Biden's new administration about regulating Google and Facebook. So, the big tech is it's a sort of Goliath versus Goliath of big tech versus the national states. So how that's going to play out is another question.
Yeah. Okay, and so I think, Moggy, you had something you wanted to say in between Jane and Tony and Adam?
Thank you. Yes, just going back to, these community gardens, allotments, you call them over there, who actually owns the land? And if you if you rent a space to grow your own veggies, do you have to pay rent for that or something?
Anyone want to answer that? Is that something you can?
Yes, I love it. I love a batch of that.
Go for it.
Yeah. Right. First of all, you need to make a distinction between allotment holders and community gardens. Right? Allotment holders are individuals that take on a perch or several perches within an allotment, right? Usually the local allotments are run, regulated and licensed by the community council, right? And they get grants for them to keep them going, etc. Right. Now, community gardening is a totally different animal altogether. Right? There is no individual, right? But there is a community that run that community garden, right? And what occurs is people grow what they feel like growing within the community garden. They're given a strip, whatever. They're given raised beds or several raised beds, whatever, right? And they grow whatever they feel like growing on that, right, along with other members of the community garden. And when that is harvest, then that is all shared out amongst the community garden holders. Right, that's the difference. Whereas with the allotments, like I said, it's the individual and it's entirely up to them, right, whether or not they share their produce amongst the other allotment holders. The other thing is about the community garden is the sharing of tools, right? All tools are shared, right, amongst the community gardeners, for whatever purpose, etc., etc. And again, like the building of raised beds, that's done as a collective. And again, when it comes to polytunnels, that's also done as a collective within the community, the community garden. Whereas in an allotment, any raised beds is put up is done by the individual, and the same goes for any polytunnels. That's the difference.
Thanks. Oh, thanks very much on that. I didn't understand the difference between the two.
Thanks, Moggy. Thanks, Brian. Now then, John. Go on, fire away.
I should have pointed out as well that benefits of the two is both parallel. The individual allotment holder finds some benefits in it, depends on how long they can stick it and their other commitments, etc. Right. Whereas the community gardener, right, benefits are shared, but also the effort is shared as well. So they can share out their time allotments. Like, you know, you can have a community gardener and come in and say, right, oh, I can give you 3 months, right? And then after that, I've got to go away, but I'll come back again later on in the year or the following year, etc.
Okay. All right with that, Moggy? Yeah. All right to move on. Yeah. Okay. So, John Cummings. Now, John Cummings is the last person that's in the queue so far. It's the back of nine, so we'll maybe need to start thinking about slowly but surely ending up. But, you know, Donny, if we're on a roll, let's keep it going. Please, if you have any other questions you'd like answering, don't forget to get your cues in sooner rather than later. John, it's your turn, mate.
Yes, tonight's discussion has made it quite clear that with every passing day, capitalism makes life more and more ruinous for all life on the planet, not just us. I think that it makes socialism all the more urgent, notwithstanding the fact that it doesn't look like it's about to happen anytime soon. But one of the things that we will have to consider now about what we'll do in socialism is all the things we'll have to do to put things right. The longer capitalism goes on, the more and more that has to be put right in terms of climate change, in terms of food production, in terms of the ruin of the oceans. It's a thing I've been interested in for over 50 years, is ecology, long before it was misappropriated as a term by a reformist political party, when it was just part of biology. And it's very, very important that that we live in what you might call symbiosis with the environment, and that we interact with it. I mean, I'm not telling party members anything new here, but the thing is, we really will need to look at how we repair the damage that capitalism's done. So the longer capitalism lasts, the more and more horrors it will perpetrate upon the ecosystem. I was horrified to find out, and I've been paying attention to these things, but I was horrified to find out that only something like 13% of the ocean is untouched by all the hazardous things that capitalism has done. I used to think that there was a lot to be harvested from the oceans, which were safer than a lot of the land was. But that's not the case, sadly. Just by looking away for not that long, I discover that these horrors have been perpetrated, and even plankton in the ocean is much diminished because of various factors within capitalism. So, as I say, the longer capitalism lasts, the more there will be a problem to be repaired, to put things right, because we have to live in harmony with the environment. We can't be a species that just goes rampaging throughout the planet and takes what we want and doesn't care for the world around us. That way spells doom for everyone. And as we know, socialism is the only way that we'll be able to do that. So that's all I have to say about that. Thanks.
Well said, John. Excellent points. Okay, so we have Paula. You got something you want to say? Oh, well said, John. And to add to that, Paula. Okay,
thanks. No, I don't want to add to that. Just wanted to say that was a nice kind of summing up about everything that's been said this evening. And thank you, Paddy, for the talk. Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll just add a couple of things. Yeah, I mean, John's absolutely right, of course, and well said. Socialism doesn't look as if it's about to happen, that's for sure. But that's today, and you know, we all know, don't we, that we can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm just at the moment just looking at what's going on in Russia with Alexei Navalny and his release of a new video. It's quite exciting that his supporters are going out tomorrow en masse, even though the state has told them they're not allowed to. They want to bring down Putin, and bloody quite right too, the corrupt bastard that he is. Maybe they will. We don't know, do we? We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And I think this is the thing that we've always got to tell ourselves, that no matter how bad it looks, we just don't know what's around the corner. So that's one thing. And then something else John said about, you know, the amount of things we're going to have to do to put things right. But the main thing that we can do, you know, as soon as we get socialism, is just stop doing things wrong. As soon as we can stop doing those things, we can start to redress the balance. John talked about marine life, and you know, the World Counts website has got a startling statistic that says there are 27 years left to the end of seafood. And they also say the end of the world as we know it in that thing. And 78 years to the end of rainforests. I'm not quite sure how they work out some of these statistics, but, you know, whether they're entirely accurate or not, we know it's bad. We know it's getting worse. And, you know we need to do something about it, and quite urgently. And the main thing to do is to stop capitalism.
Excellent. Tremendously well said, Paddy. Okay, comrades, well, as I said a few minutes ago, it's now 9:10. I'm not sure if we're maybe going to come to a natural end, although it would appear as though Comrade Buick is having another type on here. Hopefully there's something else to say or add to it. Certainly been a very interesting evening tonight. Some excellent contributions from everyone. Adam seems to have dried up. I don't know if you got something else you want to round off by saying. Let's see what else. Got another contribution from Freddie going on here. Let's see where this leads to. I mean, certainly, you know, I think one of the things Adam said earlier on that I thought was particularly relevant and poignant, and that's in much the same way as we have issues over nuclear power and such like, and the whole sort of idea of mass-produced food and agriculture. You know, there may be a need, if we are going to meet the needs of the population of the world, that there may well still be a need for some form of large mass-produced food. And again, if we want to keep ourselves warm, there may well be a need for nuclear power. But all of these things would certainly be managed a much more sensitive way to the environment. You know, there are all sorts of things to be made about that. But in much the same way as Mark predicted, in terms of you know, fewer and fewer people controlling the means of production. Again, you know, it's becoming increasingly relevant and a matter of great importance that we take that control back and install the democratic socialist society that we desperately need if we are to survive on the planet too. So yeah, lots of stuff having to take into consideration there, and much of it answered by Paddy tonight. So I suspect, I don't know, Paddy, if there's anything in particular that you want to finish up by saying, by rounding off and maybe bringing the talk to a close tonight. Can I hand that over to you to do that, comrade?
No, I can't really add anything to the discussion. It's been a really good discussion. Yeah. I think lots of people had some really good things to say. I'm feeling guilty about my crapness with allotments, but apart from that, it's been really useful. I suppose one other thing, just to address, you know, this kind of, you know, we can sometimes get a bit depressed by, you know, the terribleness of the world situation, but I suppose the thing to remember at our level, at a personal level, is that we're still going, you know, despite the lockdowns, despite everything, you know, we're still operating and we're going to keep operating. We're not going to give up until capitalism is, you know, we've stuck it in the dustbin. That's what sustains us. That's what motivates us. You know, that's what keeps us going. And let's keep going doing that. That's all I've got to say.
Excellent. One day, comrades, it will be a thing of the past, and hopefully in a lifetime as well. If I can maybe just sort of add a note tonight, how it might be worth mentioning that if anyone has any ideas or suggestions for any future topics, maybe even better still, would be willing to give a talk, then if you can get in touch with Adam, he'll be the one to help take that forward. As I said earlier, there really isn't any need to be shy. We're all amongst friends and comrades. You know, it's not a competition like the X Factor that we, you know, you see who gives the best performance. We're not here to judge each other. We're here to try and learn from each other. So, you know, if you have got any ideas for topics, then please do get in touch with Adam and see what you can bring to the table. Yourself for discussion. I'm sure it'd be most interesting. But in the meantime, you know, I'll have to thank you all once again for coming along tonight, and and then saying what you had to say, and thank Paddy in particular for another most enjoyable and interesting discussion, and looking forward as always to the next one. We'll call it a night at that, comrades, unless anyone else has got anything they want to say. Sound okay with everyone?
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.